You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 8th, 2015. The music should be up. 2015, my name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, James McCommons, professor of English at Northern Michigan University, on his book, Waiting on a Train, The Embattled Future of Passenger Rail Service. Also on the program today, the Troika gives Greece 5 days before they shut down their economy. Also on the program today, Marco Rubio comes out with a disruptive plan to basically make indentured servants out of college students and to, well, that's about it. Also on the program today, Elizabeth Warren proposes a reinstitution of Glass-Steagall. And just a moment ago, folks, we had a report about an hour ago that United Airlines was, all of their planes were completely grounded because I guess they had some type of computer program, failure or something. And then the trading on the New York Stock Exchange also stopped because, I guess, supposedly because of a computer glitch. The WallStreetJournal.com is down. Ostensibly, one imagines, because of some type of server problem. But we are live. Matt still has yet to have his child, but they seem to be on standby. So, you know, bear with us. Also, I should also say that starting tomorrow, I am on vacation until a week from Monday. Michael will be doing the program tomorrow with Noah on the board. And also, I believe he'll be doing a pre-tape for Friday. And next week we have 4 new shows for you. Members will also get stuff from the Deep Archives. I'm going to talk a little bit later about one of the shows based upon a story today. They're all great shows. There is one where I interview Murtaza Hussein, who is a writer for The Intercept. And he has a piece out about the Fort Dix Five that is just stunning. And it's a great piece of reporting, but it's also incredibly, it's outrageous. And later in the program, I'll talk about another story, the juxtaposition of which is just, I'm beside myself about it. I really can't express it, how outrageous it is. But we will get to that later in the program. And, of course, we will give you an update on what's going on in Greece. You have a situation in Greece now where you have 40% of the children living in poverty. Youth unemployment is 50%. I think across the country, you're talking about 25, 30% unemployment. People are limited to, I believe it's $60 a day in U.S. dollars that they can take out of their banks. As of Saturday, or I believe it's Sunday, they, when the next payment is due from Greece in terms of their loans, and they will not make that payment. There's just simply not enough money in Greek banks. Essentially, there'll be no money. They're going to have to create a new currency if there's no deal made. And essentially what the Troika is now saying, and the EU is saying, essentially Germany is saying, is, yeah, the deal we offered you before your referendum, we're only going to accept a harsher deal. This is just sort of, this is masochism, sadism, I should say, on a global scale. Very creepy stuff. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to James McCommons, English professor, author of Waiting on a Train, The Embattled Future of Passenger Rail Service. We'll be right back after this.
Yeah.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program James McCommons. He is a professor of English at Northern Michigan University and author of Waiting on a Train, The Embattled Future of Passenger Rail Service. Welcome to the program, James.
Thank you.
So, you know, just to give people some, just a slight background on your book, in 2008, you spent essentially the whole year riding, I guess it was it exclusively Amtrak, or is that almost oxymoronic to say if you're riding a train across the country, you'd be riding on anything other than Amtrak? But you logged 26,000 miles in 2008.
That's correct. If you're riding inner city, between major cities, you're riding Amtrak. And, of course, I also rode commuter trains, subway trains, as I got around the country. My idea was to ride the entire Amtrak system and look at how mass transit, particularly rail, worked, and also how it integrated with other forms of mass transit like buses and airplanes. And I tried to get everywhere I could in order to interview people and do it with just mass transit. And I was able to do that, but it was difficult, and it became part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating tale, and I think I'm also very partial. I'm also a huge fan of train travel. As a kid, I remember going down to Florida on a sleeper car train. I think my folks took us on. I'm not quite clear why they did that, but and I once took a train from Oakland to Boston. I made it to.
Okay.
And thinking that I would have some really interesting conversations. And then I think over the course of that, I realized I'm not so great with making with engaging in conversations with strangers, I guess, unless it's on a podcast. So be that as it may, tell us how Amtrak was born, because this is a fascinating story, I think, and it explains a lot of what of how people experience Amtrak today.
Well, Amtrak was born in 1971. It was really a compromise between losing all passenger service and at least retaining some. The railroads, which were really built out in the country using or hauling both freight and people, by the time the interstate highway system was built, we all started driving cars, and of course we're a big country, we're using airplanes. The passenger traffic really went down. The other thing that happened too was that we used to move all the mails and packages by train, and that was an important service as well. And that went away in the 1950s and 60s. And so by 1970, the railroads were in deep trouble. Their passenger services were losing lots of money, and there were bankruptcies going on. And so the government stepped in, reorganized it, and created this thing called Amtrak that we've had ever since. And it's sort of a quasi-public system in order to move passengers. And it's never really been well-funded. It's always been sort of a stepchild of something between nationalization and total government support.
Before we move forward...
It really hasn't changed much in all these years.
All right, so I'm just going back, So there was a patchwork of private rail services around the country. Is that what it was? I mean, how did that how was that born? How did that come about?
Well, I mean, when we wanted to build across the country, the government gave land to private interest, often these railroad tycoons back in the 1900s, in order to get them to build the tracks. And so many of them were given land on either side of the tracks. And naturally, people then were moving by rail as well. So we always had sort of a private model of passenger service in this country that at a certain point by the 1960s was not really working anymore, whereas in other countries it was always a public entity, and that's why those train systems have survived, partially because the governments continue to support them and make them grow. And we're still trying to figure out what to replace this private system with. And Amtrak has sort of been something that was supposed to maybe not last that long, but it was an interim step, but it's lasted till now.
And so it was basically a patchwork of private services that were subsidized by the government. Was there the freight lines and the passenger rails, or I should say, were the freight rails and the passenger rails in the 19th century, in the 20th century, were they all the same system?
That's right. They were all the same system. When Amtrak was created, the idea was that the freight railroads would continue to own the infrastructure. They would run freight, and they would allow Amtrak to run on it on their rails for a certain fee, and that fee has been negotiated over the years. So Amtrak owns almost no tracks except in the Northeast Corridor. They own the Northeast Corridor between Boston and Washington. They own a few other sections of track around the country, but largely their entire system is run on the lines of the freight railroads.
And who's responsible for upkeep?
The freight railroads are.
Okay, and so they Amtrak owns. How did it come about that they own the rails in
the Northeast Corridor? Because the Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central, which combined at one point, in an effort to stay in business. Very soon after that went bankrupt. So when the Penn Central went bankrupt, the government stepped in, gave the Northeast Corridor to Amtrak, and then As far as the railroad goes, they created Conrail, which ran around the Northeast to deliver freight. The government funded Conrail, and then when it became profitable again, they reprivatized it and sold it. Now it's part of CSX and Norfolk Southern.
Interesting. And so were there other, I guess, proposals on the table other than this sort of hybrid situation for Amtrak?
Yeah. Well, you know, we could have let all passenger system go away. In a sense, there would be no more passenger trains in the country. Or we could have stepped in, nationalized it, and created a public-funded train system. Amtrak is a hybrid of those. And the idea was that we'll create Amtrak, and someday we hope Amtrak will be profitable. But the fact was, in my book, I went back and talked to people who actually helped create Amtrak, and none of them thought that Amtrak could make a profit. They all thought that there would have to be government subsidy to run the train system, as there are government subsidy for all forms of transportation
right. In
this country. Amtrak is nothing special in that way.
And in some ways, it is the idea that Amtrak would have been profitable has been very problematic, it seems to me, at least from a political standpoint.
It's been used as a sort of a way to bludgeon Amtrak. Look, you're not profitable. You said you were going to be profitable. You were created to be profitable. Well, that will never happen. Amtrak's always going to need, or any system we decide to come up with, is going to need public subsidies in order to operate. Subway systems do that. Commuter systems do that all around the world. The airlines don't pay for the airports. The taxpayers pay for the airports. The taxpayers pay for the roadways in this country. Transportation is subsidized by the public. And transportation is a public good, so it's something that we see as a benefit, that we can move goods and services and people around on our transportation system. What we don't have in this country is a very good rail system when it comes to moving people. We have a pretty good one when it comes to moving freight.
And so what's the and Amtrak, I mean, that's, I guess that gets to like Amtrak's sort of dual mandate, right? It's to provide as much, to reach places as much as possible and to be profitable. And those two things just simply can't happen any more than it did. I mean, I guess it's just not possible to do that, right?
It's not. And if you think about it, if you compare it to our interstate highway system, we build interstate highways across vast stretches of country where there are very few people. And we don't do that because there's a lot of people in those regions. We do that to create a nationwide network. And rail is the same way. I mean, you know, you need to connect these different areas with long-distance rail. There's some excellent areas in this country where high-speed rail would work well. The Northeast Corridor, around the Chicago hub in the Midwest, Florida, Texas, California, all of those are great for high-speed rail. But you're going to need to connect those regions together to get a nationwide network.
And part of, I mean, ultimately, I guess this just comes down to political will, right, to spend the money. And it seems, I mean, I was sort of shocked by the stats that you had in there. And I imagine they've changed a little bit from 2008, or I guess the book in 2010. But the percentage of Americans that actually go on inner city trains is really low. I mean, I was surprised.
Very low. It's very low. And it probably hasn't changed that much, even as the population has increased. We don't have trains that are convenient for people. People talk a lot about high-speed trains, but what's more important really is frequency. So when you have a city pair, say Chicago-Indianapolis, where only one train goes there a day, there's not going to be a lot of people riding it. But if you had 5 and 6 trains a day where a business person from Indianapolis could come into the city and do their business during the day and then get back on at night and come home, you have a lot more traffic. And where you have corridors like that and frequent train service, it works very well.
And so we're talking about what, about 2% of Americans ride?
2% of all Americans have ridden an intercity train. So, that's correct. I mean, I ride the trains, and I still do today, I meet people all the time that have never been on a train before, have no idea how it works, don't realize that they're not, you know, they can get out of their seat and walk around because it's not like an airplane. We don't have a rail culture in this country because we really haven't had a system for now 2 generations that really is part of people's lives. And, of course, that's very different than in Europe.
Back in 1920, which I have learned from you, that was essentially the peak of, rail saturation. Do you have a sense of what the percentage of people were that used it then? I mean, and was it simply the interstate highway system?
It was the way to get around. I mean, as we built out the road system, as people could afford, as Henry Ford, you know, made the car affordable to people, people were able to, you know, have their own vehicle to move around, and had roads to drive on and places to go. It's only natural that, in a sense, we would have more people driving and less people riding trains as another form of transportation came along. What the government really stopped doing by the 1920s and the 1930s is helping the railroads keep up. While on the other hand, government's completely subsidizing roads all over the country and is subsidizing airports all over the country, too. Railroads really got ignored when it came to public subsidy, largely because, again, it was a private system, and the idea was that these railroads don't need any help. And those railroads at one time were very powerful organizations, and they weren't popular with a lot of people.
What do you think accounts for this sort of, I mean, there's some real political animosity that comes, I mean, I guess not primarily, but primarily, I think, from the Republican Party. And, you know, George Bush essentially tried the Deep Six Amtrak, as far as I can tell. What accounts for that?
Well, I think one thing that it accounts for it is that Amtrak was set up with this false premise that it was going to become profitable, and that wasn't in the cards from the very beginning. So people still hang on to that. Journalists still hang on to that. They often use the term Amtrak, which has never made money, or money-losing Amtrak.
Right.
They never say that about money-losing airports or money-losing roads. So I think Amtrak's always been a good whipping boy for the politicians, that here's a piece of government waste and we can get rid of it, and it's never done what it's supposed to. And if anybody really wanted a train, then private industry would step in and build that. And that's just not true.
Well, they failed at it already, didn't they?
What's that?
They private industry already failed at maintaining it.
Well, they, you know, I mean, they maintain the service to move freight, and I think railroads are going to become more and more important as time goes on in moving a lot more goods in this country. They have great potential to do that, and perhaps they can get back into the passenger business. Right now, they have no desire to do that because it's not going to be a money-making operation. There has to be a private-public partnership to move rail forward in this country. And we're stuck in this model that we've had since 1971 where the freight railroads don't particularly like Amtrak. Amtrak isn't well-funded by the government. And so we have this system that limps along, doesn't necessarily get much better, and at the same time, the politicians are unable to get rid of it, partly because trains do run through their districts, including Republican districts, and Amtrak has in the past had some big Republican defenders. There are Republicans that do get rail. They understand that we need a better rail system in this country. But that's largely just a few of the Republicans. The Democrats generally want to support Amtrak, but we still don't have any kind of mandate or will to actually fund this the way it needs to be funded, or to create partnerships with the freight railroads in order to move more goods and more people.
You mentioned an uneasy relationship between the freights and the and Amtrak, and to a certain extent, that explains when Amtrak is late. That explains why they're late.
A lot of times they're late because of the freight railroads, and a lot of times they're late because the freight railroads have problems with capacity. Where in 1920 we may have had two and three tracks in some places, we now have one. So we reduced the capacity of the system to handle a lot of traffic. And so there's problems going through Chicago. There's problems going up through North Dakota. Once the oil trains that started moving out of there a few years ago, that there's just too many trains, not enough track. Passenger trains do not get priority, even though they're supposed to. And so
explain that dynamic, that they're supposed to and they don't get priority. I mean, how does that work?
Well, that works because there's been this relationship between the freight railroads and Amtrak that has always been problematic. And there's been times where, yes, the railroads have purposely delayed passenger trains so they could run their freights. But what I found out writing the book, that a large part of it is simply due to capacity. It's like having a small hose with a lot of water going through it, and things get jammed up. And because we have we don't have a lot of repeat trains in the system. We only have one, then those folks get stuck. They can't get off and get on the next train coming by. So we get jammed up, and that happens a lot.
When the freight trains don't give priority to the passenger trains like they're supposed to, like what is the recourse? What is the process for that? Does it go to?
There's a legal recourse. They could go to the Surface Transportation Board. Amtrak has done that in a couple instances, but they've not been aggressive about it. And partly trying to work it out with the freight railroads on their own. And there's an argument on one side that Amtrak could be a lot more aggressive in pushing its rights, which have been agreed to by the freight railroads.
Go ahead.
That's a lot of lawsuits, a lot of time. And things have gotten better, and then they've gotten worse. It often depends on the economy. When the economy is doing well, there's a lot more traffic out there on the railroads. When things went bad, back in 2009 with the recession, Amtrak's on-time performance was quite good, because there were fewer freight trains out there.
Back in 2008, and as you were writing the book in 2009, were you more hopeful for what was going to happen with rail service because there was talk of of the stimulus? And I think at that time, if I remember correctly, now the high speed rail that was slated for Florida was axed.
Yes,
and things looked a lot more hopeful. I mean, I think now they're starting to run into some problems with the high-speed rail in California. Give me a sense of where we are now, in your mind anyways, from where we were about 5 years ago.
Well, I think 5 years ago, that book ended on a whole hopeful note, in the sense that that with the stimulus package, money was going to flow into certain states and certain routes where a lot of planning had already been done. There were basically shovel-ready projects that, you know, that could happen. And frankly, it was a bust, partly because in Florida, which was ready to build a high-speed train between Orlando and the East Coast of Florida, was ready to go, got $1 billion, and Governor Rick Scott, you know, gave that money back. He refused to use that money for rail. Scott Walker did the same thing with $800 million in Wisconsin. Wisconsin might be the worst example in the sense that the state of Wisconsin had been advocating to build a train between Milwaukee and Madison for many years. They had a state rail plan that had gone through a Republican governor and a Democratic governor, and they were right on the cusp of, you know, building this train. Plus, they had a very successful service, and still do, between Milwaukee and Chicago, where a train runs seven times a day. Scott Walker gave that $800 million back to the government and to the feds. That money was earmarked for rail, so the $1 billion in Florida and the money from Wisconsin all went to California to their high-speed project. Walker ran against the train when he was campaigning for his first term, and then turned around and, sent the money back. John Kasich, also in Ohio, Governor of Ohio, sent that money back as well. There was about $500 million there for a train between Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Columbus. So I was hopeful then, but from what I've seen, Amtrak is continuing to limp along, not much better than it was back then, and not much better than it was 20 years ago.
Wow. And in California, that seems to be going forward, although I think there was a recent spate of lawsuits from certain communities that basically said, we've changed our mind. We don't want to go in through our communities.
Now, you know, I mean, it's very controversial out there, but ground has been broken. California voters did pass a $10 billion bond issue about 8-9 years ago to spend money. California got an influx, I think, of $2 to $3 billion through the stimulus package. So they have enough money to get started. They've gone from an authority planning and running that project to the State Transportation Department stepping in and really taking over the project. And that's under Jerry Brown, who has made it a priority in his administration that he's going to get this thing started. It's going to be very expensive. It's going to take a lot of time. There's going to be a lot of lawsuits. But I do think that system will be built because I think all the economics, despite the huge cost, the project makes sense.
And so, all right, so let me ask you, the getting off of policy, what are some of the best train lines just from a passenger experience? I mean, when I went from Oakland to Boston, I think it was this was 25 years ago maybe, but it was the Zephyr. There was a glass, a glass car, and I could, as you're going through, I think it was the Rockies, I think it was the Zephyr, but you tell us, what are some of the best train lines, both from a sort of a scenic way and maybe perhaps one in terms of convenience?
I think there's a couple trains that I really like taking, and one of them is the Empire Builder, which goes up through North Dakota and then goes through Glacier National Park, across Idaho, and in Seattle, Portland. It's a beautiful train. Interesting, it goes through a lot of interesting small towns, and you do meet people on the train there who are using that train to get back and forth to the places they live. That train is real important in the across the Dakotas and Montana for those people for transportation purposes. The Southwest Chief from L.A. Up through New Mexico, Colorado is a very nice train. And then, of course, you mentioned the California Zephyr. The Zephyr goes from Denver across the Rockies, which is extremely scenic, over to Grand Junction, Colorado. Very pretty train. I was just recently on the City of New Orleans from Chicago down to New Orleans. That's a nice train as well.
All right, so there you have it, folks. If you have the opportunity to take those rides, take those. James McCommons, thanks so much for your time today. It's fascinating stuff. I'm a big fan of trains, and I hope at one point our country makes the choice to invest in it.
Right. I think it's going to be inevitable that we're going to do this, both for passenger and for freight. But we need to have a vision of where we want to be with this, and we're going to need a public-private partnership. This is an important infrastructure project for the country, and we're going to need it to move forward. We need to build two more tunnels into Manhattan.
Yes.
On the Northeast Corridor, the train in the Northeast Corridor, when it goes through Baltimore, is running through tunnels that were cut during the Civil War.
Wow.
And those Baltimore tunnels, you know, are curvy. They slow the train down. If we actually want a world-class system like many countries have, we're going to have to do these things. They're long-term projects, but they're good projects, and they're going to be important to the economy.
There's
a great payback for these projects.
We should remind people that when you talk about the additional tunnels under the Hudson, there, that was another example of federal money being basically, well, and I mean, I think there's actually some evidence that Chris Christie spent a chunk of that money, but basically shut down the federal funding for that other tunnel. And we're just a couple of years away, as far as I can tell, from one of the existing tunnels being shut down for repairs. And that's going to, it seems to me, it's going to have a severe impact on the New Jersey economy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. These are important projects. I mean, George Bush talked about, you know, he was going to shut down Amtrak. And it's like, well, if you shut down Amtrak, then you're going to shut down the Northeast Corridor. And who would dare shut down the Northeast Corridor? That's how important that, you know, that system is. And you saw what happened with that accident in Philadelphia.
Indeed.
And the fact that we couldn't move those trains through there. We have no redundancy in the system. You know, this becomes a severe problem.
The book is Waiting on a Train, The Embattled Future of Passenger Rail Service, James McCommons. We will link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to head, I guess we should head in there now, but let me just talk about this one story. It's a little bit of a non sequitur. I want to get to what's happening in Greece, and also, you know, it's just fascinating to me how Donald Trump is literally just leading the entire Republican Party. He's like their intellectual. He's become the new Rush Limbaugh on some level, but is actually running for office. I mean, he is dictating the terms of the entire Republican race. And without being too self-congratulatory, since I'm going on vacation and I won't have the opportunity to be self-congratulatory for the next 8 or 10 days, as predicted, Donald Trump was going to have the greatest impact on this race than anyone. And if Michael wasn't such a millennial, he would have that would have come up before. You didn't even turn up your own mic. Michael's working.
I just wanted to say that I've said from the beginning, I understand that the sensei needs emotional support.
That's right.
And I think that you've been totally on target with
Trump. I know. I just wanted to. I know. I was fitting a square peg into a round hole.
I know. You can do better criticizing. Than that.
Yes, I can. And I will. And
that.
I will.
I know.
But before we get there.
At very least, you'll attempt.
Let me just talk about this, because on Wednesday of next week, we'll be running our interview with Murtaza Hussein, who was one of the reporters who wrote a piece for The Intercept on the Fort Dix Five. I'd encourage you to read the piece either before or after the interview, because we got to some stuff in the interview that wasn't explicit in the piece. But I want to just read. I raised that because of this story that was, I think, reported today by AP or Reuters. I'm not quite sure whom. And the Fort Dix Five is a story of five men, Muslim men, who were, were completely railroaded. I guess to tie it into the interview we just did. Completely railroaded. They are in prison. One of them's in prison for life. For 30 years. Three of them are in prison for life, leaving behind multiple children. When you hear the interview, you're going to be shocked. But let me just read this story to give you a sense of just how racially, ethnically motivated these prosecutions are. Just the level of injustice that we're talking about. A Tennessee man, apparently living in upstate New York, I believe, was indicted on Tuesday of this week, yesterday, for a plot to burn down a mosque, school, and cafeteria in a small rural New York town with a large Muslim community. 63-year-old former congressional candidate Robert Duggart advertised his plot on Facebook, tried to recruit others to join him in his mission to cut them to shreds. Duggart was released into custody of two family members last week. Now, I'll tell you something. When you hear this interview on Wednesday of next week, the idea that this guy would be released to family members relative to what these guys were sent to prison for life for, it's going to blow your mind. There was Nihad Awad, the National Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, said in a statement, "It's deeply troubling that an individual who's admitted to planning a religiously motivated terror attack on American Muslims is now free, while the intended targets of this plot remain unprotected." Apparently, there is a small village, Islamberg, in New York. It was founded by Muslims 30 years ago. And Duggart wrote that the town is vulnerable from many approaches and must be utterly destroyed in order to get the attention of the American people. "We shall be warriors who inflict horrible numbers of casualties on the enemies of our nation and world peace," he added in another post. In wiretap conversation with an undercover source, he allegedly planned to attack the town with an M4 military-style assault rifle, pistol, and machete. He allegedly passed along maps of the area as well as information about gun laws in New York and literature about the hamlet. I guess maybe he met with the source in Nashville, Tennessee. He was arrested on April 10th. But the incident failed to attract the same amount of attention as other potential terrorist plots, such as the plan to behead the organizer of the Draw Muhammad event earlier this year. Now, look, it's quite possible that this guy is just simply mentally deranged. and is likely that he is, well, I mean, I think it's clear he's deranged. But it's possible that that is the only factor involved here. Let me just stipulate that that's a possibility. When you listen to this interview on Wednesday of next week, it's just going to... I pre-taped this, I think it was last week, and I cannot think of anything else.
Yeah, I was just looking it up because I'd never heard of it. And this is, you know, this is according to Wikipedia, so take it with it what you will. But it was founded by a Pakistani Sufi cleric, and that's, of course, mystical, quote-unquote, moderate Islam. And it was founded in the 1980s, and a lot of African Americans moved there from New York City to escape crime, poverty, and racism. And it's a community built of 40 family houses and its own grocery store, bookstore, place of worship. So it's kind of, I mean, it's almost like a commune, kind of. I mean, it's just so fascinating to me that, you know, the bigotry that would drive that terrorist attack or that plotting, and then the actual brand of Islam is something that you hear very little about in any type of media.
It's funny because I remember when I went to the 928 rally, 828 rally, I think it was, the Glenn Beck rally down there. I specifically remember one woman who was like, do you realize that there's a whole training ground of Muslim terrorists up in New York State? And I said, I'm not aware of that.
Now you are.
But now I am. Unbelievable. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Folks, like I say, you will barely notice that I am gone over the next couple of days, or for that matter, that Matt's gone. We don't know what's going on. I think it's, you know, there was
some big wrestling matches going. That's what's going on.
We do have, we are speculating in the office that the whole Matt is having a child thing is really just a ruse so he can go to some type of extended wrestling conference, or that there's some type of like monster drink challenge. That's
like a monster drink challenge, and he's just taking breaks to occasionally text us that he's not coming in and Photoshop himself into baby pictures.
That's well, we haven't gotten those yet.
No, but I think he's preparing. I mean, Matt's a smart guy. He knows that this is the long game here to pull off this kind of con. Next is why we can't meet the baby.
I can't wait until when he announces his the baby on Twitter, and then we go back into his feed and pull up on how he was, talking smack about babies and whatnot. That, of course, is Matt's side gig and
public shaming joke there. I like it.
All right. So just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off, free shipping. Buy the Majority Report blend. Get that coffee, folks. Makes a great gift. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me via the app. Pick it up at majorityapp.com. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, should we take one? La poupe qui fait non.
Fuck off.
I give her my love, she says no, 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 no. I give her my heart, she says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only says no, no, no.
Just ain't no.